There's no other way.
San Francisco. It's 8 o'clock.
When it's time to face the music and hit the road again, I'll have Craig beside me, my road-rated friend. Fills my car with music, mellows out my day. Getting only good sounds, nothing's in my way.
Just keep on the beat, keep on the street while you're moving. My left or my traveling style.
There's a lot of car stereos on the road, but there's only one that's road rated, the Craig Road Rated Receiver. It's made to pull in the good sounds and keep out the fuzz and the fading. It helps you hang on to your favorite station. The Road Rated Receiver, only from Craig.
Just keep up the beat, keep out of the street while you're moving.
To be Craig.
My left or my traveling style.
KFRC is proud of the John Lennon Special. It was produced in San Francisco by some very special people here at KFRC. It was our intent to broadcast the special without commercial interruption. Unfortunately, the broadcast rights to the special are controlled by the RKO Network in New York. That network has chosen to sell commercial time during the special. KFRC did not sell any commercials locally, nor will we accept any money from the network for the commercials they sold. Any comments about their commercials should be directed to the RKO Network in New York. Again, we apologize for the commercials, but not for the special. Thank you for sharing it with us.
John Lennon, the man, the memory. Dedicated to Yoko Ono. December 8th, 1980. The dream is over. John Lennon is dead. John Lennon, the idol of millions, devoted husband of Yoko Ono and father to Sean Ono Lennon, was brutally gunned down in front of the Dakota, his New York apartment house. The suspect in custody, a 25-year-old man from Hawaii who seemed to pattern his life after Lennon's and admitted to the vicious killing without hesitation or remorse. Mark Chapman spent hours outside the Dakota apartment building waiting for Lennon, and according to the security guard and New York City police, fired at the man whose music moved millions as he walked from his limousine to the entryway of the Dakota.
Mr. Chapman came up behind him and called to him, Mr. Lennon, as he arrived at that doorway. And then in a combat stance, he emptied the Charter Arms 38 caliber gun that he had with him and shot John Lennon.
New York City Chief of Detectives James Sullivan says Chapman dropped his gun after the shooting, waiting to be apprehended, as John Lennon was fatally wounded.
I was passing with Dakota, and I saw John and Yoko come out of the limousine.
A woman identified only as Nina was outside the Dakota at the time of the shooting.
They walked out of the limousine, they walked up the path, into the gate, and halfway up, just about when I was approaching the corner, I heard shots. Loud shots. They were ear deafening. And I stood there for a minute, and then I walked across the street. There were two joggers there. They stopped also. They asked me, did you hear those shots? And I said, yes. And I said, I don't know what happened. And I said that John and Yoko went into the building.
Lennon was rushed to nearby Roosevelt Hospital with Yoko Ono at his side. She was shocked. She couldn't believe it. And she begged police to tell her it wasn't true, that it hadn't happened. But by the time Lennon arrived at the Roosevelt emergency room, the world Yoko Ono knew came crashing down with a sudden and violent finality as the official statement was made.
John Lennon was brought to the emergency room shortly before 11 p.m. He was dead on arrival.
John Lennon had dreamed during life of a world united by love. Perhaps we've never come closer than in the hours after the death of John Lennon. Anyone who came through the 60s and 70s with their eyes and ears open couldn't help but be touched by the profound musical and sociological impact of John Lennon. In a lot of ways, he defined and shaped our culture, and certainly he commented on it. You didn't have to know all of John Lennon's lyrics or every event in his life to mourn his passing. All you had to do was feel for Lennon from the heart. And from the flow of tears and the swell of music following his shooting, it was obvious how close to the heart Lennon had come to all of us. Just a few hours before the dark event that would turn the Dakota apartments into the scene of a horrible killing, as New York City itself turned dark, a team from the RKO Radio Network sat with John Lennon and Yoko Ono for the only radio interview granted following the release of their new album, Double Fantasy. I'm Dave Sholin, and along with Laurie Kay, Ron Hummel, and Warner Brothers' Burt Keen, I sat and talked with John and Yoko for almost 3 hours. In that amount of time, I know we all felt like we had made two good friends. What follows then, the interview that we all congratulated ourselves on and felt better about than any other. We only hope that, in some small way, it serves as a tribute to a great man and as a comfort to his grieving widow. We began talking with Yoko Ono alone, a person that John Lennon said changed his life. In the past 5 years, their role reversal led to a business life for Yoko and a house husbandship for John. And throughout their enduring relationship, Yoko Ono was John Lennon's stabilizing force and guiding light. That was the sentiment behind Starting Over from Double Fantasy. No matter what the couple had been through, it was time for an outstretched hand and lots of love.
In Starting Over, that's what Joan is saying, though it's a song that's written to me. But, I mean, it is to his woman. But, in fact, he is addressing to all women, you know. And I think it's beautiful. And so each time when I hear that song, I feel like choking up again, you know. Oh, I love it. '80s is probably going to be, and I'm very optimistic about that, that we're going to start a dialogue all over again, which will be beautiful.
The Beatles had the top five numbers at one time, right? So I can never get more than I've ever had in that respect. I'm not saying I could never have four, five numbers at once, because I'd be wishing myself bad luck. But let's face the reality. I've had the boyhood thing of being the Elvis and getting my own spot on the show. I want to be with my best friend. My best friend's my wife. Who could ask for anything more? I'd sooner do something else together than not work together. And that's why I think that comes across in the work now. And we feel like this is just the start now, you see. Double Fantasies, this is the first album. I know we worked together before, we even made albums together before, but we feel like this is the first album. I feel like nothing happened before today.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. Well, they give me all kinds of warnings to save me from ruin. I'm lazy.
device designed to enlighten me. When I tell them that I'm doing fine, watching shadows on the wall, don't you miss the big time, boy, you're no longer on the ball.
Relaxing with Sean, and I was here working, taking care of the business. And I mean, I would have joined him if I liked that sort of thing, but not only that, I was busy, but I don't really enjoy being in a warm place, you know. I like New York. So anyway, so and then we were having conversation on the phone every day. So he would call and say, how's this, you know, or he would say, are you tired? Do you mind if I just sing you one? And it was so funny because, you know, we felt obligated, of course, to listen to each other's song. And when we have a song that we want to let the other person hear, you know, we're just all dying like this. Yeah? I'd be saying, would you mind, John? Are you tired? Oh, not another one, you know, that way. No, because it's hard, you know, it's hard to listen to somebody else's song. But in a way, because we both liked each other's songs in this album, particularly, that it worked out very well.
Oh, it came over me all of a sudden, love. I didn't know what came over me. I was possessed by this rock and roll devil, you know.
Well, partly because suddenly I got the songs, you know.
You never know, you know. Those things just come to you.
Just suddenly, like, had, if you pardon the expression, diarrhea of creativity. And in fact, we went in the studio and cut about 22 tracks and cut it down to 14 to make the dialogue. They were all dialogue songs, meaning that we were writing as if it was a play and we were the two characters in it. But it's real life, but not real as well, because on a song or a record, it can't be real. I mean, we could have taken it a step further and made this record so maybe she would be called Ziggy Stardust and I would be called Tommy. And then you would call it a rock opera, you see? But we always worked from our own selves as near as we could. So the album, the work we did on this thing, is really a play. But we're using ourselves as the characters. And what we sing about in the record and the songs are real diaries of how we feel, but also it's always not really, really real, because it's a song and it's on a record and you project it in a different way.
it was bigger than both of us, in a sense. I mean, we didn't try to be together. And also, we're still not trying to be together or anything like that. It just seems like a very functional relationship. And this time when we were going to make Double Fantasy, because we haven't been working together as artists for such a long time, so we were both very scared. You know, I thought we were going to start fighting like a dog and a cat, you know, like really fight over remix or whatever. So I was depressed about it, and Joan felt that too, probably. And when we went in the studio, we found that we were somehow ticking and starting to work together in a very inspired way, and we couldn't believe it. It was really truly a dialogue in that sense, you know, that I would make one song and sing it to him over the phone, and then he reacts, you know, to that in a way. And then he would write another song, and vice versa. You know, he would write a song, and I was like, oh, all right, that's how he feels. Okay, how about this? You know, it was really interesting.
We had discussed going back in the studio, but I didn't have the material, but I wasn't worried about it because I thought, well, I haven't done it for a long time. If I switch into that, there'll be something there. But it just sort of came, and I called her because I was in Bermuda with Sean, and she was here in New York. I called her and I said, well, look, we were talking about recording. It must have triggered something off here because I'm getting all this stuff. And I started singing it to her down the phone or playing a cassette. And she would call back 2 hours later and say, well, when you sang that, Losing You, or she'd come back with Moving On or something. And then I'd say, oh, Moving On, okay. And then I'd be swimming or doing anything. Suddenly something else would come, like starting over. I'd say, hey, well, look, this is what happened. And it started working, like, coming out like that. So then I couldn't wait to get back and start then. I suddenly had all this material. After not really trying, but not trying either for 5 years. I'd been so locked in the home environment and completely switched my way of thinking that I didn't really think about music at all. My guitar was sort of hung up on behind the bed, literally. And don't think I took it down in 5 years.
Well, both of us were very nervous. But at the same time, we were so excited with the songs, you know. We knew they were going to be good. And we had 22 songs. And it was very hard for us to choose for the first album. It's like that. And we decided that we should put songs like Losing You and Moving On in. Though some people might think they're sort of negative. But and we tried to make sure that the whole tone of the album would be on a positive side, because that's very important. But to throw that in was very important to show that people go through that too. It's like a catharsis, you know, that people go through that with us and see what happens. And then in the end, hard times are over for a while maybe, but you know, that sort of thing. We wanted to show a real picture, not just sort of all pretty, you know.
It inspired me completely. As soon as she would sing something to me or play the cassette down the phone, I would, within 10 or 15 minutes, whether I wanted to work or not, if you call it work, I would suddenly get this song coming to me. And I always felt that the best songs were ones that came to you rather than... I do have the ability to, you know, if you ask me to write a song for a movie or something, and they say it's about this, I can sit down and sort of make a song. I wouldn't be thrilled with it, but I can make a song like that. But I find it difficult to do that, but I can do it. You know, I call it craftsmanship, you know. I've had enough years at it to sort of put something together, but I never enjoyed that. I like it to be inspirational from the spirit. And being with Sean and switching off from the business sort of allowed that channel to be free for a bit. You know, it wasn't always on. It was switched off, and when I sort of switched it on again, zap, all this stuff came through. So now we're already... we did half enough material for the next album, almost half as much, and we're already talking about the third album, so we're full of vim and vigor.
It was very strange. Just when we finished... stringing the songs together for the album, and we're saying, ah, it's over, we're finished, you know, we strung it together. And then in the next room, somebody was saying, quick, come over here, because Starting Over is playing. So we just rushed to that room, you know, And we heard it for the first time with that ding, 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 you know. By the way, that's the ding, 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 that's sort of a bell for wishes, you know. And if you make a wish and you hear that ding, 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 you know, and your wish will come true. So it's that one. So it sounded so good, you know, so good. And we just felt like, oh, well, we did it then. We did it, you know.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone.
It's been me too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. My no time flies so quickly.
Watching the Wheels. Those three songs, especially Watching the Wheels, even now when I hear it, and this is after remixing and, you know, doing all that stuff. I mean, I heard it over 100 times, really. But really makes me choke up. You know why? Because Watching the Wheels is a song that sums up what he was doing this past 5 years. And I went through, you know, with him in a way. And it was very hard for him because people were very suspicious about it. You know, like, what are you doing now? Oh, I'm not doing anything. when is your next album coming? You know, that sort of thing. And even now, when he declares that he's a house husband, I mean, it's an aspect of it that, you know, when it was on the news, a newscaster who's a guy was definitely very embarrassing. You know? Well, he's now a house husband, so he claims, you know, that kind of thing. And his face was changing, you know. And I think it's a very courageous thing to do. And a lot of people say, oh, I mean, this album is just full of love songs. What's that, you know? But he knows all that aspect. It's very easy for him to do a macho song, you know. Just another rocker, you know, and say you know, whip a woman or kick them out of the room or whatever, and get drunk and with the boys, you know. I mean, that image is so prevalent, you know, in the rock world, and it's so easy to keep that up, you know. But at the time that is the macho image, to come out and say, I'm a house husband and here I am with a son, and I still love my wife, which is, you know, people get embarrassed, you know. What is that, you know? And I think that's a very courageous thing to do.
The queen is in the counting house, counting out the money. The king is in the kitchen, making bread and honey. No friends and yet no enemies. Absolutely free. No rats aboard the magic ship.
In 1975, John Lennon and Yoko were blessed with the child they'd wanted so badly, their son, Sean Ono Lennon.
He was born on October the 9th, which I was, so we're almost like twins. You know, the funny thing, if he doesn't see me a few days, or if I'm really, really busy, you know, and I just sort of get a glimpse of him, or if I'm feeling depressed without him even seeing me, he sort of picks up on it. And he starts getting that way. So it's like I can no longer afford to have artistic depressions, which usually produced a miserable song, but it was something I could use, you know. So if I start going really deep, sort of wallowing in a depression, to it, I kind of enjoy it or whatever one does with them, best you can, he'll start coming down with stuff, you know, so I'm sort of obligated to keep up. But sometimes I can't, because something will make me depressed and there's no way I can deal with it. And then he's sure as hell he'll get a cold or... come, or trap his finger in the door, or something will happen, you know. And so now I have a sort of more reason to stay healthy and bright. I cannot no longer wallow in it and say, well, this is how artists are supposed to be, I suppose, you know, make it, write the blues, you know.
John told us he didn't want to repeat his macho mistakes of the past. He wanted to be a true father to Sean, a round-the-clock daddy.
A boy was really programmed to go in the army. That was about it, you know. And you had to be tough, and you're not supposed to cry, and you're not supposed to show emotion. And I know Americans show more emotion and are more open than English people, but it's pretty similar over here. There's that Calvinist, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon ethic, which is don't touch, don't react, don't feel. And I think that's what screwed us all up. And I think it's time for a change.
Lennon obviously realized that he could never be called a typical father. His fame and wealth made that label absurd. But the love in John Lennon's heart for Sean, and the desire that love created to spend as much time as possible with his boy, led to some deep thinking on raising a child.
I took the time. Any famous star or whatever it is where you come under, and I'm not going to name any names, but many of them that have problems with their kids, either, you know, either killing themselves or... in various ways, I don't buy that bit about, you know, quality over quantity. You know, like an hour a week of intense rolling in the hay together is better than, you know, 20 minutes every day of you being bitchy and just being yourself around him. So I don't try and be the God Almighty kind of figure that never is always smiling and such this wonderful father. I'm not putting out an image of this person who knows all about it. Nobody knows about children. That's the thing. You look in the books, there's no real experts. Everybody's got a different opinion. You learn by default, in a way. And I made a lot of mistakes already, but what can you do? But I think it's better for him to see me as I am. If I'm grumpy, I'm grumpy. If I'm not, I'm not. If I want to play, I'll play. If I don't, I don't. I don't kowtow to him. I'm straight with him as I can be. And yes, I can afford to take the time, But anybody with a working wife might be able to afford to take the time if they're not really not a working wife because they're poor and they both have to work. But I know lots of dads who aren't working that hard, who are just sitting in an office all day anyway to avoid life, you know. I mean, they're sitting behind desks and they're doing nothing, just shuffling paper, right, waiting for lunchtime to get a cocktail. But I don't buy that, you know, my career is so important that I'll deal with the kids later, bit, which I already did with my first marriage, my first child, and I kind of regret it. My other son by my first marriage is 17. I don't remember seeing him as a child. It didn't even enter, like most guys are 24, 25, they're too intent on the career, really. Well, Yoko was a poor artist when I met her, okay? And living in not the best conditions, and she had a child, and the child went wherever she went. You see, she didn't treat her first child like I treated mine.
Stage, you know.
She took her on stage, you know, I mean, a little squirking thing. On the, and she would take her when they were making movies, because I saw, before we got together, I've seen her work and the way she worked, and the Kyoko was running around all over the place. And there are many artistically inclined people that have worked like that in the past, not since the 60s, but in the 30s and any other time. So even if I was poor, it's the state of mind I'm in. I would work out some way for him to be around us somehow, okay? I would have chosen my career to suit that. You don't have to be rich to love your kids. You know, I learned a lot from the child, because they're not hypocrites and they're not phony, and they know when you're put... I mean, he knows already, you know? I mean, already he makes me feel... You know, anybody with a child that spent any moment with them, you know... you know, and it's good for you, I think, because one does tend to fool oneself, and the kids don't buy it.
He was saying, remember, that he wants to be a daddy when he's older.
Oh, yeah, this is because I hadn't been in the studio for 5 years or whatever, so he's used to me being around all the time. Because it's a pleasure for me to hang around the house. I was always a homebody. I mean, I think a lot of musicians are, you know, you write and you play in the house anyway. Or as when I was wanting to be a painter when I was younger, it was all in the house, or write poetry, it was always in the house. But I started the work, you know, and he started seeing a bit less of me. I'd let him come to the studio, but it was a bit boring, he was excited, but long story short, at the end of the session, and it was going on, I got back on a night schedule where I'd be coming in when he'd be getting up, so he'd see me at breakfast, but I was a sort of shredded... Okay, what? Oh, like that. Then one day we were sort of lying down on the bed together, so I'm maybe watching some cartoon or whatever. And he just sat up and said, you know what I want to be when I grow up? And I said, no, what's that? He looked me right in the eye and said, just a daddy. And I thought, I said, you mean you don't like it that I'm working now, right? I'm going out a lot. He says, right. I said, well, I'll tell you something, Sean. It makes me happy to do the music. I might have more fun with you if I'm happier, right? He said, That was the end of that. I mean, I think I was BSing him, you know, but he caught me off guard there because I'm just a daddy.
Close your eyes.
busy making other plans.
The man, the memory, continues in a moment.
Because of the nature of this documentary, KFRC chooses not to include any of its own advertising. Our network, however, requires that we hear from their program sponsors. Our deepest apologies for this interruption.
Juliet, you've got a great pair of legs.
Take it from me, Juliet Prowse. Nothing beats a great pair of legs. Legs pantyhose have memory yarn, so they always fit beautifully. Legs stretch when you stretch, bend when you bend. No matter what you're doing, legs are always fitting.
Stretching, bending, standing, there's one pantyhose that's always fitting. Nothing beats a great pair of legs.
In the last couple of years, I must have tried 7 different shampoos. And you know what? I keep coming back to Herbal Essence. I keep coming home to Herbal. I keep coming home to clean. I keep coming home to fresh and good. The things that Herbal Essence means. Summer sweet wildflowers and herbs. That's what makes Clairol Herbal Essence so special. To me, nothing smells like Herbal or makes me feel like Herbal Essence does. Come on home to clean. Hey, Herbal, I'm home.
A daddy to his and Yoko's child was the ultimate fantasy for John Lennon, and so was the outcome of their latest studio work together.
You know, you go through two ways. Sometimes you think, wow, yeah, great. This is great. We've done it. And then the next time you hear it, well, she's not quite the same as Al. Think, oh, this is not right. It's not right. So I would go yay and nay on it all the time. But I think basically we thought,
If people will listen to it for what it is
and not listen to it with preconceived ideas of how it ought to be or as compared to something else, then if people could listen to it just as if it wasn't even John and Yoko, just that it came over the radio and you accept it or not accept it as you hear it, not as you expect to hear John Lennon or expect to hear Yoko Ono or expect to hear an ex-Beatle or expect to hear whatever, or having read a good review or a bad review, forget about that. Just get it on the radio, I thought, and it'll be all right.
The way I looked at it was probably it's an album that's not going to do too well, but in the end, you know, maybe like 2 years later or something, people said, that was good. Because I knew that the theme was good, I knew the dialogue was important, etc. And each song was all right, you know. So I had a feeling that even if it takes a long time, people would know about it, you know. But I didn't know it was going to be that instant, you know.
The instant acceptance of Double Fantasy comes from the positive message of the album and the sincerity of the loving thoughts John and Yoko put into it. John felt the emotional honesty they put across in the musical dialogue opened themselves up to the public.
Even as I put it in my last incarnation, everybody's got something to hide except for me and my monkey. It means really that, you know, one cannot be absolutely oneself in public, because the fact that you're in public makes you have to have some kind of defense or whatever it is. But we always tried, from whether it's from Two Virgins through Imagine, through anything we've done together, the films we made together, we always tried to get as near to the uncensored, as it were, for what we are, not to project an image of something that we're not. Because having been in that sort of pop business so long, and tried to retain myself throughout it, but obviously not always being successful at that, it was most uncomfortable when I didn't feel I was being myself. you know, when I would have to smile when I didn't want to smile. And it became like all that, like being a politician, you know. And what I really got through this 5 years was I'm not running for office. I like to be liked. I don't like to offend people. I would like to be a happy, contented person. I don't want to have to sell my soul again, as it were, to have a hit record. I've discovered that I can live without it, and it makes it happier for me. But I'm not going to come back in and try and create a persona who would not be myself.
Until he could be himself in his music, John Lennon wouldn't head back in the studio.
It's like the channels on the radio were jammed, you know. I was not getting clear signals. And after 10 or 15, almost 20 years of being under contract and having to produce two albums a year in the early days and a single every 3 months, regardless of what the hell else you were doing or what your family life was like, what your personal life was like, nothing counted. You just had to get those songs out. Now, Paul and I turned out a lot of songs those days, and it was easier because it was the beginning of our relationship and career. Paul and I developed in public, as it were. We had a little rehearsal in private, but mainly we developed our abilities in public. But then it got to be format and sort of not the pleasure that it was, and that's when I felt that I'd lost myself. Not that I was on purposely being a hypocrite or a phony, but it took something away from what I set out to do. I started out to do rock and roll because I absolutely liked doing it. So that's why I ended up doing a track like Starting Over. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. You know, it's... it's sort of a la Elvis and that. And I hope people accept it like that. I think it's a serious piece of work, but it's also tongue-in-cheek, you know. I mean, I went right back to my roots. All the time we were doing it, I was calling it Elvis Orbison. You know, and it's not going back to being Beatle John in the 60s, it's being John Lennon, whose life was changed completely by hearing American rock and roll on the radio as a child, and that's the part of me that's coming out again, and that's why I'm enjoying it this time. I'm not trying to compete with my old self or compete with the young new wave kids or anything like that are coming on. I'm not competing with anything. I'm trying to go back and enjoy it as I enjoyed it originally.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll.
Inspiration has always been rock and roll, and for at least the last 12 years, Yoko Ono. Before Yoko, there was another important relationship for Lennon.
I was saying to somebody the other day, there's only two artists I've ever worked with for more than one night stand, as it were. That's Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono. I think that's a pretty damn good choice, because in the history of the Beatles, Paul met me the first day I did Bebopalula live on stage, okay? And a mutual friend brought him to see my group called the Quarrymen. And we met and we talked after the show, and I saw he had talent, and he was playing guitar backstage and doing 20 Flight Rock by Eddie Cochran. And I turned around to him right then on first meeting and said, do you want to join the group? And he said, And I think he said yes the next day, as I recall it. Now, George came through Paul, and Ringo came through George, although, of course, I had a say in where they came from, but the person I actually picked as my partner, who I recognized had talent and I could get on with, was Paul. Now, 12, well, however many years later, I met Yoko, I had the same feeling. It was a different field, but I had the same feeling. So I think as a talent scout, I've done pretty damn well.
But John wasn't exactly acting as a talent scout when he first met Yoko Ono.
It was sort of 1966, and I got a call from a guy called John Dunbar, who used to be married to Marion Faithfull. You know, everybody's connected. And he had a gallery in London called Indica Gallery, an art gallery. And I used to go there occasionally to see whatever art show was on, you see? And he said, oh, I've got this, there's this fantastic Japanese girl coming from New York, and she's going to do this other thing, but she's also going to put on an exhibition at my gallery. And it's going to be this big event, something about black bags. And I thought, ooh, orgies, you know. You know, these artists, they're all ravers. You know, it was in the days of happenings and paint and all that stuff, right? So, oh, I go right down there, you know, for the opening. Goody, goody, you know. You know, goes down, see what's happening. I get down there, and it's the night before the opening. I thought there was going to be a big party and an opening and the whole bit, you know, a big I didn't want to get involved. I wanted to watch, you know. I get there, it's all white and quiet, and there's just these strange things all on display, like an apple on a stand for £200, when the pound was worth $8 or something, or whatever. And there's hammers with insane hammering in, all this very peculiar stuff, and a ladder with a painting on the sky, or it looked like a blank canvas on the ceiling with a spyglass hanging from it. So I'm looking around, and there doesn't seem to be many people. There's a couple of people downstairs, and I didn't know who was who. So I get up the ladder, and I look through this spyglass, and it said, yes. And I took that as a personal positive message, because most of the avant-garde artists of that period were all negative, you know, like break a piano with an axe. It was mainly male. I'm looking at the female here. It was mainly male art, and it was all destructive and, you know. But here was this little crazy message on the ceiling. And then the guy introduced me to her, and she didn't know who the hell I was. She had no idea. You know? She was living in a different environment altogether. And I was saying, well, I thought, this is a good con, isn't it? Apples for £200 and hammer and nail. Who's going to buy this, you know? I didn't know what concept art was, which in a nutshell is the idea is more important than the object. So that's why you won't see many rich concept artists around, because you can't really, you know, like the guy that wraps up Christo wraps up things. Well, he doesn't expect you to buy the canvas. What he's doing is selling you this idea, whatever it is he's projecting. It was the same kind of thing, but I hadn't come across it before. I was thinking, how do you sell a nail and a hammer, you know? So anyway, gallery owner was all fussing around. He was thinking, well, is he going to buy something? And she's ignoring me, you know. So he introduced us, and I said, well, where's the event, you know, where's the happening? Because I'd seen the bag. So she just takes a card out and gives it to me and just says, breathe. So I said, you mean that? She said, you got it. I said, uh-huh, all right, I'm beginning to catch on here. You know? And then I see this hammer, this thing hanging.
I just remember his nose. He did it exactly like that.
Well, you know, what else are you going to do? That was the big event, you know? I mean, all the way from New York for that. So I see the hammer hanging on the thing with a few nails underneath. I said, well, can I at least hammer a nail in? You know, I've come all the way from the suburbs for this. And she says, no.
This is before the opening, and I wanted everything to be right, you know.
The thing messed up, you know. So anyway, the gallery owner has a little word with her, and she says, she comes over to me, she says, all right, no smiling or anything, because you know how she is. She's not running for office. She never was. So she looks at me and she says, you give me 5 shillings. Give me 5 shillings and you can hammer a nail in. So I looked at her and I said, I'll give you an imaginary 5 shillings and hammer an imaginary nail in, okay? And that's when we connected really, and we looked at each other like, you know, that sort of, something went on. Well, I didn't see her again for a few weeks. We went to a Klaus Oldenburg opening, and I went with Paul, and I don't know who she was with, but I got separated from Paul, and I felt this sort of vibe behind me. And I looked round, and there she was, you know. And we're both very shy, believe it or not. And I don't know what I said. We said something. We didn't really get together till 18 months later. We didn't make love till 2 years. We knew. You think we're rock and rollers, you know, all the life that people lead. It's all right sort of coming on with somebody you know that's not going to go anywhere. You know, it's easy to sort of one night stand and groupies and that, but with a real relationship, I was so paranoid, and it was 18 months or a year before we even got near to each other physically, as it were. Because I didn't know how to treat somebody, a real woman. I only knew how to treat groupies, really.
I flew life's energy.
Developed, and in spite of the ups and downs, John and Yoko came through the 70s together.
I think both of us, in our own way and together, really stood against it in a way. You know, we said, okay, well, try to destroy us. We couldn't be just destroyed that way, you know. And we managed it, we feel.
It was quite a long trip, but we've been together now longer than the Beatles, you know that?
That's interesting, isn't it?
People always think in terms of John and Yoko just got together and the Beatles split, and we've been together longer than the Beatles.
I don't feel that we're a role model, because I think each person has his or her karma, own karma, and their needs are different in each person. And when we were separated and Joan was doing his thing in L.A. and I was doing my thing here and all that, we weren't saying, well, look, you know, do like what we're doing. And when we didn't have a child, we weren't saying, well, look, you know, you shouldn't have a child. I mean, it's the same thing now. For us, this is what happened, you know. I'm not even saying this is what is the best for us. I don't know what is best or what should be, but this is what happened, and we did our best, and we're just surviving, that's all.
John Lennon believed in Yoko and her love like nothing else in the world. He says she saved his life and taught what a real relationship was and how deep feelings can really be. Yoko learned from John as well.
Before I got together with him, I was a macho woman, and I was really sort of like, I was going my way, kind of. So if I was with somebody, I would not really face his problems. I was like, oh, just leave me alone about it. You know, I have my own problems, you know. And when I got together with John, because he's a strong guy, I had to face it. You know, I had to face his problems too. And I realized that men go in this society, men do have their problems too. I mean, like, he came from Liverpool, he was not in the right class, or, you know, and auntie telling him that he has to be a veterinarian or something, you know, that sort of thing. And they go through hell. So I realized that men do have problems as well. And that was a very good education for me.
Lennon had his education too, what he calls his lost weekend in Los Angeles, an 18-month separation from Yoko at her request that brought out some of his most painful and self-destructive music and memories.
Don't need a song.
was being separated from Yoko and realizing that I really, really needed to be with her, wanted to be with her, and could not literally survive without her as a functioning human being. I just went to pieces, and I didn't realize that I needed her so much.
John Lennon, the man, the memory, continues in a moment.
Because of the nature of this documentary, KFRC chooses not to include any of its own advertising. Our network, however, requires that we hear from their program sponsors. Our deepest apologies for this interruption.
When it's time to face the music and hit the road again, I'll have Craig beside me, my road-rated friend. Car with music mellows out my day. Getting only good sounds, nothing's in my way.
Just keep up the beat, keep up the streak while you're moving. Mile after mile, traveling style, keep on grooving.
There's a lot of car stereos on the road, but there's only one that's road rated. The Craig Road Rated Receiver. It's made to pull in the good sounds and keep out the fuzz and the fading. It helps you hang on to your favorite station. The Road Rated Receiver. Only from Craig.
Just keep up the beat, keep out the street while you're moving.
Got to be Craig.
Mile after mile, traveling style, keep on moving. Just keep up the beat.
KFRC, San Francisco.
Thank you.
Fine Dream came from John Lennon's L.A. bachelor period.
I was haunted, all right, because I realized that I needed her more than she needed me, and I've always thought the boot was on the other foot. You know, and that's as honest as I can get. And the image is always, because the pop star, and Burt Reynolds said it, and God bless him, mm-hmm. that he's the women have always kicked him out. And Yoko kicked me out. I didn't go off on a, I'm going to be a rock and roll bachelor. She literally said, get out. You know, and I said, okay, I'm going. You know, I'm going bachelor free. I'd been married all my life. You know, I'd been married before Yoko, and I immediately married Yoko, so I'd never been a bachelor since I was 20 or something. So I thought, it was god-awful. And the other thing I want to say about Burt Reynolds, Barbara Walters asked him, what do you want to be remembered as? And he said, the best father that ever was. Yeah. And I thought, thank God, you know, I began to feel maybe I'm the only father that's interested in relating, and is it going to become, oh, John Lennon's now selling this family business, and he's been through peace and love, and now he's coming on like daddy and all that. And I'm only talking about it because that's what I've done and that's how I feel. And admitting that it is that I'm more feminist now than I was when I sang Woman is the Nigger. I was intellectually a feminist then, but now I feel as though at least I've put my body where my mouth was and tried to really live up to my own preachings, as it were. And to see somebody like Burt Reynolds, who is the world's number one male star over all the pop stars worldwide, to have the guts to say he wants to be known as a father, I thought, oh, great, I'm not going to be alone on this one.
But Lennon was alone in Los Angeles during parts of 1973 and 1974. The events that ate away at his and Yoko's relationship proved temporarily too much in control.
When we got together, and of course there was an element of being sort of like really crazy about each other or something, so that was all right. But, you know, when his macho side was sort of coming out, you know, here and there, and I was like, what is this, you know? And on top of it, the world was against me. So, I mean, the whole world is behind this macho guy, you know. What's this, you know? And I was really getting sort of upset about it. So, by the time it was 1973, was it? I just felt like saying to John, well, look, why don't you just go to L.A. and have fun, you know, leave me alone, you know. And I just wanted to think straight, because I couldn't think straight anymore, or that going on, you know. And then when we came back together again, I think that he really tried hard in a way to make it work. And all the things that he did since then, I just can't help, you know, I started to have a sort of a renewed, or whatever you call it, just a great respect for him. I thought, wow, I didn't know that this guy can do this, you know. I mean, I knew that he could do other things. I mean, he's talented, you know. I mean, and all that. But this I didn't believe that he could do, you know. One is to just leave the whole business to me. Just give me a carte blanche. I think it's, you need a lot of courage to do that, you know. Like saying, here's a blank check, you want to take care of it, you know. And in fact, he gave me it was symbolic, but gesture. But he gave me a blank check, just signed it, and I had it framed. You know? Great, you know. And also, he felt that he should take care of Sean. But that was not for me, in a way. I think he wanted that experience. And I think that a lot of people, a lot of guys really want to, secretively, you know, there's some guys who want to stay at home. That suits their temperament or whatever. Or they want to cook, you know, but they're sort of shy about it. There are a lot of guys like that, you know. And I think he enjoyed cooking. I think basically he likes to stay at home. And he doesn't like to do business, you know. Now, I never did business either, but I prefer doing business to staying at home, let's put it that way, or taking care of a child. I just can't do it, manage it. So it's just an individual difference. But it worked out very well, because then By that time, the world made it so difficult for me that the only area that I can channel my energies into was this family business. So I thought, all right, let's do that, you know.
Then, as in 1968, the year he and Yoko brought out their Two Virgins album, he felt the pressures of the press, which tended to criticize harshly whenever Lennon did something outrageous, even in his experimental music on Two Virgins with Yoko.
I used to have a place where I worked in the house again, upstairs, in my first incarnation with my other wife and kid. And I used to make kind of freaky music at home. And you would hear it coming through on things like Tomorrow Never Knows on Revolver or Rain and some little backwards things, but I never made that the whole track.
Freaky stuff, cassettes,
but
you know.
At home I would make far freakier stuff, you know, which I would take the sort of most usable and add it to the Beatles, or to my tracks of the Beatles, or the Walrus, the Strawberry, or whatever, fiddle around a bit, or put loops, or, you know, something fun. But at home I was really far out, and I had a kind of little studio, which was really just a lot of tape recorders, and we made Two Virgins that way. She came over for a date, as it were, and I didn't know what to do, and she didn't know what to do. I said, you know, I didn't know what to do with her, so I said, you want to go upstairs and play with the tapes? You know? So, because we didn't know what to do, we did play with the tapes all night. And we made Two Virgins, and I was showing her all my different tape recordings and how I made the funny sound.
Running
I was running around pushing buttons and playing the Mellotron, and she started into the Yoko Ono stuff, which is now stuff you hear on B-52s, Lenny Lovitz and all that stuff. She started doing this, and all that, and I thought, this is great, and I was going on the tapes, and she was going, and we made a tape all night, and in the morning we made love as the sun came up, but we'd made this album's worth of sound together without consciously setting out to make something. That was the first togetherness. And we shot the cover ourselves privately, and it wasn't, you know, we just got somebody to set the camera up, took the shot, and put out Two Virgins. That was the start of the whole shebang.
It took Lennon 5 months to get the other Beatles to approve the Two Virgins album cover. The stark, unflattering nude self-portrait was turned down by the record company, and the album was distributed independently. John mimics the public outcry of 1968 against him and Yoko.
What are they doing? This Japanese witch has made him crazy and he's gone bananas. But all she did was take the bananas part of me out of the closet more, you know, that had been inhibited by the other part. It was a complete relief to meet somebody else who was as far out as I was, you know. That was the real thing. Oh, now we'd like to have a commercial success. But when we made Two Virgins, we weren't worried about commercial. We just wanted to put out a statement of where it was at. You know, we wanted to share the thing.
Naively.
Well, not naively at all, because some people accepted it and a lot of people
That's
didn't.
True.
But the thing had an effect. That the fact that, you know, an Elvis Presley would take his clothes off and expose... Now, we had other shots for that cover, which made us look a lot more sexy and attractive. Believe me, you know, if you pose a certain way and you just do it like this.
Better.
And there were a couple more shots that later came out in the calendar with the Live Peace in Toronto album where we look a little more attractive as a couple in a star kind of way. But we deliberately chose the one where we were standing there, you know, in all our glory, like a little flab around the waist, the legs a little, you know, nothing pretty about it. We wanted to say, we met, we're in love, we want to share it. And it was a kind of statement as well of an awakening for me, too, you know. This Beatle thing that you've heard all about, this is how I am, really. You know, this is me naked with the woman I love. You want to share it? And people did and people didn't, but now you can't get it for $200, Two Virgins, right? So that's the way it goes.
Standing in the dark at the Hampton. Get to Holland or France. The man in the mash says,
1968, Yoko was the one influencing John with her far-out artistic and creative concepts. John says he wishes he'd been more open to many of them.
Some of the ideas that she wanted both of us to do then, I must say I was more square then than I am now in a way, that I wish we'd done because now other people have done them because they... And I would say, no, I'm not going to do it. Are you kidding? I'm not doing that. You know, I would start reserving, you know. So I don't want to do that, you know. We're in enough trouble as it is, you know, let's not do that.
And also, I started to feel guilty because, for instance, he wrote a song called Part of the People, which is a very powerful song. And then my Open Your Box was on the B-side, and of course that was banned in America, you know, and that sort of thing started to happen. So I felt that maybe I was doing a disfavor to him in a way because, well, you know, he could be number one all the time, but now because he's involved with somebody a bit radical or this and that, that he's getting that, you know, well, if you ban the B-side, you're banning the single, you know, this, that sort of thing. And I was starting to feel guilty a bit. But on the other hand, well, we did a lot of interesting things and we were having fun, you know, as well. It was exciting. Women is the Nigger of the World, which was the first...
That was banned, Woman is in the Nigger of the World, because of the word nigger. Now, I had Ebony and Jet both say they are not offended, and we went down there with Dick Gregory, and just in case there were any questions there. And the statement, Woman is the Nigger of the World, was made by Yoko in 1967 or 8 to an English woman's magazine called Nova, which was a kind of Vogue. And she was on the cover, and the title was Woman is the Nigger of the World. I immediately stole the title and wrote a song. It didn't come out till 71. And there's all this hullabaloo about the word nigger, but the hullabaloo was from the white community, you know, not from the black community, because they understood where it was coming from.
Because they don't think that they're niggers, and that's why they didn't care. But, I mean, the whites, you know, basically said, well, niggers, well, that's terrible.
She came from a background of classical music, studying piano at 5 and all the things that rich kids do, you know. And Schoenberg and Webern, she'd studied at Sarah Lawrence and all that. I didn't know any of that stuff. And she was turning me on to her. Even Bertolt Brecht. I knew when we did Sometime New York City, to me, we were doing a newspaper. Mm. So one would rush it out into print, you see. So there were mistakes, say, a little harmony wasn't perfect. We didn't go back and perfect every note. We just printed it out, you know. And sometimes there's words missing or something like that. And it was later that she said, well, you know what we did there? I said, no, well, we got into a lot of trouble, that's all I know. And, you know, the harmony's funny or something, yeah? Because we had her idea again. She had Chairman Mao and Richard Nixon dancing naked on the cover. It wasn't really their bodies, we just stuck their heads on. Well, the record company stuck a label on it in the supermarkets, and you couldn't even get it off when you went home, you know? And there was no genitals, nothing on it. But anyway, she... And I started getting down about that record, saying it was a mistake. We even though we tried to say something about women, we tried to say something about love and peace or whatever, the war, that, you know, we got into so much trouble. And so she then took me to see Richard Foreman's production of the Threepenny Opera of Bertolt Brecht, which I don't know when it was originally out, in the 20s or the 30s. I said, oh, I see, so we're not alone, you know. I don't know what happened to Brecht when he first put that out, but it was the same idea, meaning... You know, to make a statement on the society right now, right away, and don't, no BS. Just say it. You know, I think this is wrong, that's right. This is my opinion.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono were always willing to take a stand with their music, especially as the 60s ended and the new decade dawned.
Communicate is the thing. It's that need to communicate. Politics was in the air those days. Come on, I mean, you know, you couldn't avoid it, right? And being artists, when we get into something, we get into it. You know what I mean? We want it to be right
so
there,
involved.
Down on the front lines. You know, but as we always said to everybody, with flowers, but still right down there. You know, we want to go all the way with it, and I think we did go all the way with it too. You know, our intentions were good.
All we are saying.
Love is the only thing that is going to change the society in that sense. I think love is a very powerful political weapon as well, and I think that if we go on like this, we have a choice of becoming used by the capitalist society, in a sense that we'll all become just components of the capitalist society, and finally be replaced by the computers, you know, or we'll just stand up and have a human renaissance, you know, just say we're human again, you know, we want to reach each other and hold each other and become human again.
Good intentions to Lenin meant not just exposing injustices or inequalities, but the most important message of all, spreading love.
Love is real. Love is feeling, feeling love. Love is wanting to be loved. Love is touch.
Continues in a moment.
KFRC is proud of the John Lennon Special. It was produced in San Francisco by some very special people here at KFRC. It was our intent to broadcast the special without commercial interruption. Unfortunately, the broadcast rights to the special are controlled by the RKO Network in New York. That network has chosen to sell commercial time during the special. KFRC did not sell any commercials locally, nor will we accept any money from the network for the commercials they sold. Any comments about their commercials should be directed to the RKO Network in New York. Again, we apologize for the commercials, but not for the special. Thank you for sharing it with us.
In the last couple of years, I must have tried 7 different shampoos. And you know what? I keep coming back to Herbal Essence. I keep coming home to Herbal, I keep coming home to clean, I keep coming home to fresh and good, the things that Herbal Essence means. Summer sweet wildflowers and herbs, that's what makes Clairol Herbal Essence so special. To me, nothing smells like Herbal or makes me feel like Herbal Essence does. Come on home to clean. Hey Herbal, I'm home.
Juliet, you've got a great pair of legs.
Take it from me, Juliet Prowse. Nothing beats a great pair of legs. Legs pantyhose have memory yarn, so they always fit beautifully. Legs stretch when you stretch, bend when you bend. No matter what you're doing, legs are always fitting.
Stretching, bending, stepping, sitting. There's one that he holds that's always fitting. Nothing beats a great pair of legs.
When it's time to face the music and hit the road again, I'll have Craig beside me, my road-rated friend. Fills my car with music, mellows out my day. Getting only good sounds, nothing's in my way.
Just keep up the beat, keep up the street while you're moving. Mile after mile, traveling style, keep on grooving.
There's a lot of car stereos on the road, but there's only one that's road rated. The Craig Road Rated Receiver. It's made to pull in the good sounds and keep out the fuzz and the fading. It helps you hang on to your favorite station. The Road Rated Receiver. Only from Craig.
Just keep up the beat, keep out the street while you're moving.
Come to be Craig.
Mile after mile, traveling style, keep on moving. Just keep up the
sort of dawned on me that love was the answer when I was younger on the Beatles' Rubber Soul album. The first expression of it was a song called The Word. Love in the good and the bad books I have read, whatever, where the word is love, seemed like the underlying theme to the universe or to everything that was worthwhile got down to this love thing. And it was the struggle to love, be loved, and express that. You know, there's something about love that's fantastic, even though I'm not always a loving person. I want to be that. I want to be as loving as possible. I want to be as loving as possible, or in the Christian sense, as Christ-like as possible, in the Hindu sense, as Gandhi-esque as possible. And we always approached different. And when I met her, even though we were from two different schools of thought, as it were, we found that was the common denominator. That's why we became the love and peace couple. Because before I met her, she was protesting against war in a black bag in Trafalgar Square. And when we met and we discussed what we wanted to do together, what we wanted to do was carry on me in my love, 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 and her in her peace, 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 put it together. That's how we came out with the bedding. Because I couldn't go down as John Lennon and lie in a bag in Trafalgar Square because I might get attacked those days. It was dangerous. It was dangerous for her, even as an individual protest. So we developed this thing of how to express what we both believe in together the best we can.
All you need is love.
Times have changed, though, and the world caught up with John and Yoko and what they were trying to do both musically and politically.
This time they're ready for us, man. We can go on and do our stuff without even stepping, without even changing a thing. We could go on right back. And I dug out the old records we'd made. I dug out the B-52s, and then I talked to my assistant who tried to turn me on to them 18 months before, but I said, no, I'm not into the music now. I didn't want to hear anything. He was trying to play me Pretenders and Madness and all that stuff, and I didn't want to listen to it. And I said, give me some more of this. What's going on out there? He brought all this you know, cookie, whatever you want to call it, stuff in. And we looked at each other and we thought, ha-ha. Mm-hmm. They finally caught up to where what we were trying to do all the time, which is another form of expression. And we thought, this time, surely, they're going to understand it. And here we are doing it again. It's not that much different from what we did. If you take the Plastic Ono Band albums, which are titleless, I call mine Mother for reference. It had Mother and God and a couple of tracks like that on. And her album, which was a same cover but a kind of reverse trick, the first track on her thing is called Why. You play that, and you play something modern now, and see if we weren't on the right track in 1969 and not.
Right on is the word.
Right on the word. Right on.
Even now, you know, I have this thing about, oh, if Yoko is on the album, oh, she's going to be the freak, so, you know, let's not buy the album. So I was very worried for John's
sake. I sat her down and said, listen. She doesn't like listening. She likes to either do or do something else.
Yeah,
I held her in the chair and said, listen to this rock lobster. Listen to this stuff, you know.
So what I did was, in this album, I'm not really freaking out so much. Even in Moving On, when I do that sort of end bit a little bit, you know, just sort of modestly. I was worried, you know, again, maybe some sort of record industry people or something would say, oh, Yoko is doing a freak number, and, you know, that might kill his chance again. So I was very careful this time.
But I wouldn't have done it if we hadn't done it together. That was the point which your insecurity makes you say that. But the fact is, if I couldn't have worked with her, I wouldn't have bothered. I wouldn't enjoy just putting an album out by myself, having to do this by myself, having to go to the studio by myself, because I've had the sort of, even though I was in a group, I've had that kind of game before. You know, I didn't want to work with another guy even. You know, the fact of man and wife working together and presenting ourselves as man and wife, not as a sexual object male, or her even separately as a sexual object female that sings love songs and is available to the audience. It's not that. We're presenting ourselves as a couple, and to work with your best friend is a joy, and I don't intend to stop it. If we hadn't had the success we'd had with this record, I would have been quite happy, because I know I can live without it.
Double Fantasy, the album that brought John and Yoko together in the studio for the first time in years, was truly a fantasy come true for both of them. But surprisingly, the album's title had more basic roots.
I was taking Sean and the nanny and the family to a little, except for Mother, who was here selling cows, in Bermuda, to the Botanical Gardens for lunch, to the Italian restaurant, because I could get espresso and Sean could get some junk food. And I was just walking in, I looked down, and it was a botanical garden, and it said, we're in the office, folks, that's why it's buzzing. It said, Freesia, Double Fantasy. And it was some flowers. And I just thought, Double Fantasy, that's a great title. Because it has so many meanings that you couldn't even begin to think what it means. So it means everything you can think of. I mean, it's a double couple. It's real life, but it's still a fantasy, because it's now in plastic and in photograph. And it's fantastic. And it sort of seemed to be perfect for a title of the album. And there's two of us. And it just sort of says it all somehow, without really saying anything, it says everything. And it's a flower, actually.
And also, you know, in the 10 years, we learned that John has his own fantasy, and I have mine too, you know. And that's all right, you see. And we don't have to unify our thoughts totally. I mean, there's an overall plan that we have, or a dream that we have, which we share, you know. But then we come from a totally different background, I mean, in a sense of men and women. And that's fine. So we're showing the difference of the fantasies, too.
Double Fantasy is reality, too. John said the songs ring true not just for him and Yoko, but for any couple with its share of problems.
We're not presenting ourselves as the perfect couple, because we don't want to get into that bag either, right? Because we're trying to present what it is, you know. A relationship that lots of other people are having, but they're maybe not songwriters and they don't express it that way. And the letters we're getting back are from couples, apart from the kids who just like it as music. The main excitement is the letters from people who are married with kids, or not necessarily married, but relating together and realizing that we're not selling ourselves as the perfect couple. We have our problems. We've had our problems. No doubt we'll have problems. But, you know, we're trying. We want to stay together. We want to be a family. And on that's the kind of level we're relating to. I am not aiming at 16-year-olds. If they can dig it, please dig it. But when I was singing and writing this and working with her, I was visualizing all the people of my age group from the 60s.
That's true.
Being in their 30s and 40s now, just like me, and having wives and children, and having gone through everything together, I'm singing to them. I hope the young kids like it as well, but I'm really talking to the people that grew up with me. I'm saying, here I am now. How are you? How's your relationship going? Did you get through it all? Wasn't the 70s a drag, you know? Here we are. Well, let's try and make the 80s good, you know? Because it's still up to us to make what we can of it. It's not out of our control. I still believe in love, peace. I still believe in positive thinking. When I can do it, I'm not always positive. But when I am, I try and project it.
Well, overall, we're getting more and more positive, aren't we? Because
we survived. That's the thing. You have to give thanks to God or whatever it is up there, the fact that we all survived. We all survived Vietnam or Watergate or the tremendous upheaval of the whole world that's changed. We were the hip ones in the 60s, but the world is not like the 60s anymore. The whole map's changed, and we're going into an unknown future, but we're still all here. We're still, while there's life, there's hope.
While there's life, there's hope. That was John Lennon's message before his own life was tragically taken just a few hours later. Lennon's last few years had been filled with love and hope and a beautiful, positive approach to everything he did. And nobody was more eager to point out the difference from his past work than Lennon himself, using Starting Over as the classic example of his outlook for the 80s.
The beginning of Mother, the Plastic Ono album, you hear this litany, you know, very slow church bell, which is like a death knell, you know, I don't believe in, and the Freudian things about mother and father. And that was a kind of negative positive. I was trying to make a positive out of a negative, but it was heavy going. And the reason this one goes ting, ting, ting is to show that I've come through. And whoever's listening must have come through or they wouldn't be here. And that's because I always consider my work one piece, whether it be with Beatles, David Bowie, Elton John, Yoko Ono. And I consider that my work won't be finished until I'm dead and buried, and I hope that's a long, long time. So to me, it's part of one whole piece of work from the time I became public to now. And that's the connecting point between that. And the 80s is like we got a new chance, you know?
Afro-life, together, it's so precious.
Chance and the promise the 80s bring, John and Yoko felt the time was ripe for human honesty in relationships.
Now I know both sides. I mean, it's better to know both sides, you know, because I went through situations where I was really penniless and I had to, you know, sort of scrounge around all that. That was interesting, too. It was an interesting experience. So both, you know, both ways it's interesting. But I had to really understand about women's problems. In a sense, I bypassed that because of my background and because after that I was being an artist here and everything. And in a way, I bypassed it until I met John and realized what women are going through. So it was a very good education in a way.
Sexual struggles only hurt our chances for coming together as loving men and women. In other words, we built up too many barriers between male and female.
Well, isn't it time we destroyed it? Because where has it got us all these thousands of years? Are we still going to have to be clubbing each other to death? Do I have to arm wrestle you to have a relationship with you as another male? Do I have to seduce her or come on with her that I'm going to lay her because she's a female, or come on at some sexual can we not have a relationship on some other level besides that same old stuff all the time? I mean, it's kid stuff, man. It's really kid stuff. And I don't want to go through life as a pretending to be James Dean or Marlon Brando, you know? In a movie, not in real life, even in a movie version of them.
Under the name of freedom, people wanted to not have dialogue with each other, but just wanted to just hang around being, you know, single kind of thing. But, I mean, it's good to... And I'm not promoting marriage or anything like that. I'm just talking about marriage of the soul, the mind, you know, sort of exchange of spirit and soul, which you can have with women or men. But, and it would be nice because, after all, this society is created by men and women, and the propagation is the basis of this society and everything still, you know. So that it's nice to have a dialogue between two sexes.
Days of John and Yoko, the love that went into their music was perhaps not as obvious as it is today. John relates this to the craziness of the times.
Not only the fact that we got together and boom, it was like an explosion, but there was also the Beatle thing about us getting together and whether they split because of us or not or whatever the reason, all that stuff. The Beatles were splitting, the Beatles were arguing, John and Yoko was getting together, the anti-Vietnam crusades were going on all over, and we were involved in so many things, and we were putting out so much work, and we were making movies, making public appearances, performing at shows, and traveling the world and doing all that. There was no time to reflect. There was only time to put out immediate impressions of what was happening.
Well, we were really honest about it. Say that, you know, maybe we were naive, but still we were very honest about everything we did, you know.
That's why I refer to the word is love on Rubber Soul. Straight through to all you need is love, to give peace a chance, to imagine there's no countries, imagine no war, in other words, to write to this moment now. This album doesn't say imagine the whole world like that, because I've said that in a way. What I'm saying now is, now let's put the spotlight on the two of us and show how we're trying to imagine there's no wars, to live that love and peace, rather than sing about it only.
Oh,
know, I mean, everybody knows what love is. I mean, it's not something that you can explain, but it's a very strong energy.
Well, I tried to define it as in my own way then, like, love is real, real is love. And it's very simple lyric, or even simplicity. I don't know which way it would go, but it's what can you call it? You can say love is like a flower.
It's like saying, what is air? And you say H2O, it doesn't mean anything, you know.
It's whatever it is when it feels good is love, and the other one is not love, you know?
That's the message John and Yoko have for their listeners in Double Fantasy. Thanks to the years of experimentation and discovery, they found the answer lies in a loving relationship.
I'm 40. I want to talk to the people my age. I'm happy if the young people like it, and I'm happy if the old people like it. I'm talking to guys and gals that have been through what we went through together, the 60s group that has survived the war, the drugs, the politics, the violence on the street, the whole shebang, that we've survived it, and we're here, and I'm talking to them. And the woman song is to Yoko, but it's to all women. And because my role in society, or any artist or poet's role, is to try and express what we all feel, not to tell people how to feel, not as a preacher, not as a leader, but as a reflection of us all. And it's like, that's the job of the artist in society, they're not some alienated being living on the outskirts of town. It's fine to live on the outskirts of town, but artists must reflect what we all are. That's what it's about, artists. Or poets, or whatever you want to call it. And that's what I'm trying to express on behalf of all the men to all the women. Through my own feelings about women, when it dawned on me, you know, my God, it is the other half of the sky, as the late, great Chairman McDougall said, right? I mean, they are the other half of the sky, and without them, there is nothing. And without us, there's nothing. There's only the two together. Create children, create society. So what's all this BS about, you know, women are this and men are that? We're all human, man. We're all human. And I am trying to say it to Yoko, but to all women, you know. On behalf of all men, in a way, if that's taking it too much on myself, I feel that artists are that. They're a reflection of society. Mirrors.
Woman, I can hardly express my mixed emotions at my thoughtlessness. After all, I'm forever in your debt. And woman, I will try to express my inner feelings. Show me the meaning.
John Lennon, the man, the memory, continues in a moment.
KFRC, San Francisco.
I get high when I see you go by. My oh my, when you sigh, my mind side just flies. Butterfly, why am I so shy when I'm beside you? It's only love and that is all. Why should I feel the way I do? It's only love and that is all. But it's so hard loving you. Is it right that you and I should fight every night? Just the sight of you makes nighttime bright, very bright. Haven't I the right to make it up, girl? It's only love and that is all. Why should I feel the way I do? It's only love and that is all. But it's so hard loving you. Yes, it's so hard loving you. Loving you.
John says Yoko led him to enlightening realizations about love and human relationships. He also wasn't above lifting her ideas for some of their heaviest musical concepts, like Imagine.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us.
Imagine was straight lift out of her book Grapefruit. There are pieces in there that say imagine this, imagine that. But I, what, you know, so I didn't give her credit. Tra la 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 la. But the point being,
the
yes,
give her credit.
Yeah, because people. So I dedicated the album to her, which is a cop out. But you know what? I was only as honest as I could be then. You see, you can only be as what you think, you know, as best you can at the time. But the point of the song, right, is. Because people keep saying, well, what are you doing? What are you doing in the bed in? What are you doing two virgins? What are you doing together? What are you doing? What are you doing? That's where we first came out with, all we're saying is give peace a chance. Literally came out of my mouth as a spoken word to a reporter.
All we are saying.
After being asked millions and millions of times, what are you doing? Well, all I'm saying is give peace a chance, not that I have the answer or I've got a new format for society, because I don't, and I don't believe anybody else has. Show me the plan, there's revolutions there.
You say you got a real solution, well, you know, we don't love to see the plan.
The Beatles' revolution, or my revolution song, says show me the plan.
Ask me for a contribution, well, you know, we all do, we won't be can.
Before we knock all the buildings down.
But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
All we are saying is give peace a chance.
Give peace a chance is imagine is the same thing. You hit it right in the head. It's just imagine. If there were no countries, not no places where we each had our little spot, but imagine there was a time, you know, when you didn't have to have a passport to go from country to country. What kind of world are we creating? Really, it used to be you could go around, you know. What is this game that you can't get, that somehow this is America and then just across the field is Canada, and that you have to have all kinds of papers and pictures and stamps and passports, and the concept of imagining no countries, imagining no religion, not imagining no God, although you're entitled to do that too, imagining no denominations, imagining that we revere Jesus Christ, Mohammed, Krishna, Milarepa equally. We don't have to worship either one, that we don't have to, but imagine there's no Catholic Protestant, no Jew Christian, that we allow it all, freedom of religion for real, I mean, for real.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
Just imagine it. Would it be so terrible?
Important that for some women that we get equal rights and things like that, but I think we go beyond that, you know. And for some people it's a big threat that Reagan is going to be in, you know, that sort of thing. But I think that we are people first of all, and there are many things that we don't know about human beings, you know. I don't know about it either, but there's an immense possibility. And I think our rights and our freedom and our power goes beyond those systems. And we shouldn't limit ourselves to that. So in a way, you know, instead of fighting for that, we can trust in ourselves, center ourselves, and rely on our own power, which is immense. Each person is like a total universe, And we're very powerful people, you know. So we should sort of realize that rather than to try to fight and get something outside of ourselves. We always had this a human race dream, you know. Like, we always wanted to fly, so now we have planes, you know. And the next, probably, dream is wanting to be peaceful.
Well, the other great dream of mankind, one was to fly, which might have taken us a long time, but it took somebody to imagine it first.
Yes, kept imagining.
Second was reach the moon, right?
Yes, which we reached.
Which we reached. Mm. Now, there was, it was, sure, it was an American in an American rocket, because that was the way history was at that time. But mankind reached the moon, because they said one giant step for mankind. It was for all of us we went to the moon.
We were always saying, you know, like wanting the moon, or, you know.
But nowadays, even football players are doing it, right? Which we were doing then, which is projecting the future in a positive way. Now, people are saying, no, you're naive, you're dumb, you're stupid. Okay, it might have hurt us on a personal level to be called names, but what we were doing, you can call it magic, meditation, projection of goal, which business people do. They have courses on it. The footballers do it. They pray, they meditate before the game. They visualize themselves winning. Billie Jean King visualizes every move on the court. What we were doing, we were early pioneers of that movement, which is to project a future which we can have goals which we can reach. Right? People project their own future. So what we wanted to do was say, let's imagine a nice future. She's right. The males, like even Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, who produced 1984, you look into Orwell's life, it was all torture and this, that, and the other, and he was brought up in a certain environment in a male-dominated society full of Marxist stuff about Spain, and they were all from the third, whatever, that period when they had those dreams of socialism answering everything, right? And their dreams fell to dust after the war. And then they wrote these books projecting this horrific Big Brother monsters controlled by robots. And even now, I think these people that project the space fantasies are projecting war in space continually, with women in miniskirts, available sexual objects, and the men with super macho John Wayne guns on their hips. I'm saying it's time for the people to get hip to that, man, because they're projecting our future. Do we want to go, our children to be out in space, our grandchildren fighting, maybe not Russians, but Venusians in space? You see, if it works for a football player and a tennis player, it can work for all of us. We have to project a positive future. I think that's what Christ and Mohammed and those people were saying in their way, in their time, for their society.
That was perhaps John Lennon's heaviest point. That without a positive outlook, humanity can't survive. That's what he and Yoko wanted to project. People have an all-important power inside themselves, and it's time to use it. Not necessarily politically, but lovingly as well.
People that are politicians rely on the fact that the people are not thinking, you know. And if each person, all of us, would really be centered, you know, and really start thinking for ourselves, then they don't have a chance. Because we're like a really very powerful gods and goddesses, you know?
In retrospect, if I was trying to say that same thing again, I would say the people have the power. I don't mean power of the gun. They have the power to make and create the society they want. We all created this together. It wasn't a few kings or a few generals. We might have invested the power in a Napoleon, or the Germans might have been hypnotized by Hitler. Does that make the Germans different from the rest of the human race? No way. You know, it could have happened anywhere. It just happened there at that moment in time. Okay? And also, the world, we do breathe in and we breathe out. So you go to the left, you go to the right. It's in the long term, it's meaningless. Even since I was a conscious of politics, it was the right in the 50s, the left in the 60s, and sort of nothing in the 70s. And it's going to the right. If everybody's going to panic and just react to an illusionary right wing that's going to kill everybody, well, that's what you're going to get. I believe that it doesn't have to be like that just because the guy has a right wing or has a different political view than other people. Now, personally, I've never voted in my life. How do you like that? Now, there's a Beatles book that was handed down the 1964 tour. a book of photographs. And on the top of it, it shows this young John Lennon in his usual big mouth way, saying, "No phony politician's ever going to get through to me." Well, I take the phony politician out because I don't think all politicians are phony. I don't think all. I won't categorize even politicians now because I've learned a lot since I was 23. But I don't think politics is the only answer, you see. I think this idea that we elect these leaders and then expect them to do miracles for us. Now, Kennedy is a big dream for everybody because he didn't live to fulfill or let us down. And it's not to negate what Kennedy was and what he means to people, but the reality is, had he lived, how do you know how well he would have done at the time, right? Or how the war would have gone and how everything would have gone. So investing leaders with supernatural powers, whether they be pop stars, politicians, or movie stars, or football hero, it don't work. It just doesn't work. Because we put them up on the pedestal and immediately we want to knock them off. So Reagan's going to go in there. All the so-called rightists are all going to be waiting for him to do what they want. And when he doesn't, because it's impossible, because the presidency is such a vast, awe-inspiring position for any man to be in, and it means a lot more than some local right-left group, that he cannot possibly fulfill the dreams of the right wing, the same way as Carter or Kennedy could never fulfill the dreams of the left wing. It is too much invested in one man, one group. And I don't believe in that.
Let us go!
Like everyone has power within themselves, John and Yoko realized they'd carry an outside power as well because of who they are and what they had accomplished.
We're fully aware of our power, whatever that is, and we nurture it and we try to be very careful about our own life because of that, and also try to communicate and, you know, communicate as much as we can with that power, you know. But all of you do, in a way. So, in degrees, you know, and then that's what you should use. And that's what it means, to communicate and to tell each other, reassure each other that we are here together.
People are believing in projecting their own power, visualizing goals, visualizing positiveness, and doing these things that are changing the world. It all takes time. You see, I think that the bit about, you know, the 60s, we're all full of hope, and then everybody got depressed, and the 70s were terrible. That attitude that everybody has, that the 60s was therefore negated for being naive and dumb, and the 70s is really where it's at, which means, you know, putting makeup on and dancing in the disco, which was fine for the 70s. But I don't negate the 60s, I don't negate the 70s. The seeds that were planted in the 60s, and possibly they were planted generations before, but the seed that whatever happened in the 60s, the flowering of that is in the feminization of society, the meditation, the positive learning that people are doing in all walks of life. That is a direct result of the opening up of the 60s. Now, maybe in the 60s we were naive, and like children, everybody went back to their room and said, well, we didn't get a wonderful world of just flowers and peace and happy chocolate, and it wasn't just pretty and beautiful all the time. And that's what everybody did. We didn't get everything we wanted, just like babies. And everybody went back to their rooms and sulked, and we're just going to play rock and roll and not do anything else. We're going to stay in our rooms, and the world is a nasty, horrible place because it didn't give us everything we cried for. Right? Crying for it wasn't enough. The thing the 60s did was show us the possibility and the responsibility that we all had. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us a glimpse of the possibility. And the 70s, everybody's going, nye, 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 nye. And possibly in the 80s, maybe everybody say, okay, well, let's project the positive side of life again. You know, the world's been going on a long time, right? It's probably going to go on a long time.
But also, you know, so the 60s was really going out and communicating and expanding. But in the 70s, people think that nothing happened. But in a way, we went back inside us. There's a lot of very interesting magical psychic things that happened, you know, and people got tuned into. And so with the 60s expansion and 70s knowledge, I think 80s is going to be another step up, you know, and be beautiful, you know.
Do things become more beautiful or easier to understand as Yoko and John find themselves growing older? How about emotions over the years?
You don't get so emotionally up and down when you're older, because when you're younger, your genes are different, your hormones are different, so it absolutely has to express different. You can become mellower without becoming rigid. I'm still open to anything. I still believe almost in anything until it's disproved. I don't have any set pattern. I don't have any set answers. I'm as open as ever, but I just maybe not so. My hormones don't work the same, that's all.
The thing is, young people in love, and they're tender. I mean, go back to I Want to Hold Your Hand. They're very more mellow songs. What are you talking about? You know, and we're talking about starting over. We're talking about falling in love again to each other, you know. And that's the most beautiful, young, fresh thing to do. Nobody in the menopausal age can do that. So this conventional idea that if people are talking about love, that means that they're out of the game, you know? And people who are talking about, you know, I want to kick your pants or whatever, you know, or or, you know, something like that, or some violent song is right on youth or something. It's a totally wrong idea.
about the idea that every individual feels the need to join some kind of movement or group. Is that a wrong idea?
There's that part of us all, including myself, that wants to belong to some group. No, I don't mean a rock group, but a group in society, because it makes you feel secure when times are hard, or there seems to be a threat of war or a threat of monetary crisis, and the media, with help from the public and the politicians, hype it up that it's the end of the world or the end of America or the end of financial empire or whatever it is. And everybody gets insecure and wants to belong to a group, including me. I was always wanting to belong to something, even though I always wanted to be the rebel on the outside. Part of me always wanted to be part of it. And it's an insecurity. I'm not saying that anybody who's become a born-again Christian or a born-again whatever the other groups are. But in general, to me, it looks like a sign of insecurity, because I recognize it in myself, that when I do go through that terrible insecurity of the world is collapsing and going crazy, it doesn't make sense anymore. Wouldn't it be easier if I was just along with these people, this few hundred or few thousand that all think the same way, and it makes life easier like that? People realize that it's not the end of the world. The apocalypse is not going to happen, no matter what some person might threaten us with. Those people have been waving those end of the world. I remember the end of the world is nigh cartoons when I was 12, you know. Our whole generation was brought up with the H-bomb. I remember Bertrand Russell and all the H-bomb, and the reason that we were rock and rollers apparently in the 50s was because the bomb might go off any minute, you know. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't think it's going to happen.
John Lennon, the man, the memory, continues in a moment.
Because of the nature of this documentary, KFRC chooses not to include any of its own advertising. Our network, however, requires that we hear from their program sponsors. Our deepest apologies for this interruption.
When it's time to face the music and hit the road again, I'll have Craig beside me, my road-rated friend. Fills my car with music, mellows out my only good sounds, nothing's in my way.
Just keep on the beat, keep on the street while you're moving. Mile after mile, traveling style, keep on grooving.
There's a lot of car stereos on the road, but there's only one that's road rated. The Craig Road Rated Receiver. It's made to pull in the good sounds and keep out the fuzz and the fading. It helps you hang on to your favorite station. The Road Rated Receiver. Only from Craig.
Just keep up the beat, keep out the street while you're moving.
Got to be Craig.
Mile after mile, traveling style, keep on grooving. Just keep up the beat.
Places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places have their moments. With lovers and friends, I still can recall. Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning when I think love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more. For people
I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more.
People who lived through the 60s and 70s, the death of John Lennon felt like the end of the world. But with his extremely positive way of projecting the future, his future with Yoko and Sean, and our future as human beings on Earth, it's doubtful that John Lennon would have wanted his death to be regarded as any kind of end. As fans of Lennon gathered outside the Dakota apartments following John's death and sang his songs to remember him, Yoko Ono asked through a spokesperson that the crowds go home. Yoko said there would be no funeral, but that since John had loved and prayed for the human race, everyone should please pray the same way for him. Yoko asked for a 10-minute silent vigil, a tribute to John Lennon, a man the world loved. John Lennon cared deeply about his family, humanity, and the music that originally inspired him. Just like people are coming together in the 80s, John said music is too. All different styles from all the past years. And he loved it all, especially rock and roll's golden greats.
But Goldie's Come On is one of my favorites. If I hear Bebopaloo, I can hear it over and over again. Every time it comes on, I switch up the thing, and I have the record still. If I hear Elvis, I heard him singing I Want You, I Need You, I Love You the other day. I mean, I was just in heaven. I know, of course I was going back to my youth and remembering the dates and what was going on when I heard that music.
Music is just a format, and we're adding many different formats, and that's interesting. But new wave is going to be old one day, too, you know, and very soon. Yeah, it'll be old hat. The minute it's out there and it's number one, that means that it's old hat, you know. And I think it's nice to discover all different forms of music, and that's nice.
Bruce Springsteen's Hungry Heart, which I think is a great record, is... To me, it's the same kind of period sound as Starting Over. I think the Cars Touch and Go is right out of the 50s. All that new wave, a lot of it is 50s stuff. But with the 80s styling, but and that's what I think Starting Over is. It's a 50s song made with an 80s approach.
Look, music form never dies, you know? And that goes right back to Chopin or Beethoven or Bach, you know? They're fresh as ever, you know? And so whatever form you use is fine. However you feel then, and it's appropriate to your emotion, that's what you should use.
I never believed that you can like rock or disco. I love disco right from word scratch, and all those complaints about it being all the same is exactly what I heard about Little Richard and Fats Domino. They couldn't tell the difference because the backing was always the same, the saxophones. But you could select from Fats Domino and Richard the best tracks, Lucille as opposed to some one that we can't even remember, right, with the same kind of rhythm. Also, now disco is part of the music scene. It's integrated into the whole. It's affected country and western. It's affected pop. It's affected the ballad. It is now part of the music. New wave will be exactly the same. It'll just... it's another wave that joins the ocean of music.
Lennon said he and Yoko were eager to jump into that ocean of music in the 80s. He said the same was true of his other musical partners years ago.
You know, that, I mean, that was the thing about the Beatles. They never stuck to one style. They never just did blues or just rock. We loved all music. You know, did In My Life, Anna on the early things, right. And lots of ballady things, you know. My image was more rocky, you know. But if you look down those Beatle tracks, I'm right there with all the sentimental, just the same as Paul or anybody else. I love that music just as much.
But Beatles aside, John Lennon wanted to make music, and he wanted to make music with Yoko Ono, the woman he loved and called his best friend.
After he came back from Bermuda, and the first night, in fact, when he came back from Bermuda, I took him to a restaurant, and we had a nice dinner, and we felt so good because after sort of about a month of separation or whatever, and just feeling a bit tipsy, a little wine and everything, and we're coming home, but we had to come home a bit early because of Sean, you know. Oh, well, we should go home before 12, that sort of thing. And that sounded like Cinderella to me, you know. And it was a beautiful night, sort of early summer, and the carriage was going in the Central Park, and, you know, you hear all this sort of the carriage sound and everything, and it almost made me feel like it was not this era, you know, sort of. It could be any era kind of thing. So a very romantic feeling, and coming back, and the gate was still open in Dakota. We just strolled in, you know. And I just went to the piano, and I just started writing the whole thing, you know. It felt good. That's how it was.
Thank you. Yes, our hearts are one, our bodies two, and it's so good. Every time we make a wish and let it come true for you too. Tra-la-la-la-la. Happy birthday, my love, I'm an angel. I'll give you everything in my magic power. So make a wish and I'll let it come true for you. Tra-la-la-la-la-la.
Lennon was filled with creativity and inspiration to make music, he said in his last interview, and then to perform.
I'm so hungry for making records because of the way I feel. I want to make some more records before a tour, so I'd like to make at least one more album before actually making that final decision of calling those very expensive session musicians and taking them on the road, you know? Mm-hmm. But when I went in there, I had no intention of going live because I've noticed a lot of people like Clash and things like that don't do any personal appearance hardly anymore, and they just make a video on the record. And so part of me would think, oh, but when we were playing in that studio, and then I don't know whether it was Tony, the bass player, or the drummer, after we'd done Starting Over, he said, can we do this again? I mean, let's take it on the road. And that was the first time it came. I thought, my God, this would be fun, wouldn't it? And if we can do it in the way we've done the album, which is have fun, enjoy the music, enjoy the performance, be accepted as John and Yoko, then I'd be happy to go out there.
But John Lennon won't have a chance to go out there as he wanted to do with Yoko and the band. Instead, there will be no stage, no concert, and no more music other than the tracks left over from the Double Fantasy sessions. For John Lennon, there will be no more earthly existence, but to say he is dead is wrong. His spirit, his love, his music, his power, none of these are gone or forgotten. For Yoko Ono, who will have to be the strongest of all, the void created by the passing of John Lennon will be the hardest to bear. If Yoko can fill that emptiness with beautiful memories of a love shared and a life lived together, then perhaps the pain in her heart will be eased. We all hope so. A great man is gone, but a great love survives.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away.
Time flies so quickly. But when I like starting
and researched by Laurie Kay with special permission from Drake Chenault Enterprises. Produced and engineered in San Francisco by Ron Hummel. Executive producer, Harvey Mednick. Our appreciation to David Geffen, chairman of the board, Geffen Records. Bert Keen, national promotion director, Warner Brothers Records. And Ed Rosenblatt, president of Geffen Records. I'm Dave Sholin. John Lennon, the man, the memory. Produced by RKO Radio Productions for the RKO Radio Network. Copyright 1980, RKO Radio Network.
Day. And love by bleeding in my hand. Oh, Lucas, 1980. Part 2 on KFRC. San Francisco.
California is awash in methods, techniques, systems, and therapies which claim to offer a way to a more fulfilling life. Some of them work for some people. Many tend to focus on a single facet in an individual's personality. Singling out that aspect is the key to all other problems. This simplification has been furthered by the way in which the media look for a single simple line that will explain what the method does. Life, of course, is much more complicated. Logotherapy is described as a practical method for achieving meaning in life. One of logotherapy's tenets holds, the person is not the problem, the person has the problem. Now, that says a lot, and it says nothing, which is why we'll spend the next half hour talking with Joseph Fabry, director of the Institute of Logotherapy in Berkeley, and author of The Pursuit of Meaning. Logotherapy certainly is not a term used in everyday conversation.
Logotherapy is a method that developed by Dr. Viktor Frankl in Vienna in the late 20s and early 30s that is designed to help people who either have no direction in life or have lost the meaning that they used to have, to find new meaning, direction, or regain new meanings and directions in their lives. Because he found that we can be healthy only if we have a sense that life makes sense to us. That we have meaning in this sense means that we feel we are useful, we have a direction, we have goals. We are part of a whole. We fit into life as such. We are not isolated, not alienated, not lonely, but we are somehow fit into something bigger.
How would you say logotherapy differs from other therapies or other attempts to put life into some sort of perspective?
Well, one of them is just what I just said. Many others don't pay much attention to meanings. The other one, difference would be that the emphasis on this, on as the human spirit, which is not a religious concept, but it's something everybody has, something which is uniquely human and has the resources of goal orientation, meaning orientation, creativity, compassion, the reaching out for other people to love, for causes to make our own, to transcend ourselves, to step away from ourselves, to look at ourselves, a sense of humor. All these things are tremendous resources that we have to be aware that we have them and make use of them. Another difference would be that the emphasis is not so much on why am I in this mess, but rather what can I do to get out of this mess. In other words, we make an inventory of where am I now and where do I want to be and what would be the first step to get from where I am to where I want to be. Another difference would be the emphasis on freedom, that I have not only the will to find meaning, but I have the freedom to find it, which it may be startling to some of our listeners. But the reason why we can say it is because our freedom is not only possible to change a meaningless situation into a meaningful situation. This is very often not possible. But we always have the freedom, and nobody can take it away from us, to change our attitude. We can gain a meaningful attitude towards a situation which in itself is meaningless. I there are many differences, but I think these are the major ones.
This time we're living in, certainly there have been, most likely always been a times when human beings have felt emptiness or great despair in the world wars and all the little wars that there have always been usually in very negative situations. It seems as though, and there's been a lot of discussion of it in recent years, while there are violent and difficult situations that take place in this country, there's an emptiness that seems in some ways to have grown out of maybe too much freedom, or that
we get to lack of direction, I would suspect. In recent years, there's been, like I say, a lot of discussion of that. Does logotherapy address that kind of emptiness?
Well, this is the center point of logotherapy. It addresses this emptiness, and it feels that the emptiness is caused by a repressed will to meaning. Just as Freud thought neuroses are caused by a repressed sexual desire or pleasure in general. If you repress pleasure, including sexual pleasure, we become neurotic. Well, this is true, but we don't repress pleasure very much, and including sexual pleasure, partly because of Freud. And what Frankl added is that it's if we repress our basic innate sense for meaning, our will to meaning, we become empty. We have what he calls an existential vacuum, which we try to fill. And we're trying to fill it with many means that are not suitable. Alcohol, drugs, violence, speed, cars, activity for activity's sake, power, material things. Well, he feels that the real basic fulfillment of this inner emptiness would be to find out what is the meaning of my life, what do I want to do with my life in general, and what do I want to do with the present moment. In what way do I respond? He sees life as asking us questions to which we have to respond. And if we respond in a meaningful way, in a way that really makes sense to us and to our surroundings, then we are really responsible in the literal sense, able to respond, to respond to the calls of life. And you can do this in a religious sense or in a non-religious sense. It makes no difference. That's one of the benefits of logotherapy, that it extends what the religion always has tried to give to the religious people, namely as a feeling that in spite of all the injustice and of all the chaos that exists, life makes sense. There is some kind of order. That this kind of order also is available to people who do not go through the religious, traditional religious channels.
Okay. Let's turn to directly to your book, The Pursuit of Meaning. And to my mind, you proceed through the various questions that come up, and that everyone faces, everyone has to face, and bit by bit. I'd like, if we could, as a means of giving the listener an idea about what is in the book, and also a little more clear idea of what logotherapy is, which is what your book is doing.
Well, what I was trying to do with this book is to summarize in one book and easy reading what Frankl has said in 23 of his books, and sometimes very complicated reading, and very often readings that are not available in English. So my purpose was to crystallize his thoughts in such a way that it's in 200 pages or less than 200 pages the American reader really can get the answers to the problems that most American readers are facing, namely loneliness, divorce, the splintering of the family, the breaking down of traditions, the alienation, the frantic search for pleasure or power or material things, the overemphasis on material things, many of these things are causing the unhappiness, the divorces, the separation between parents and children, and between old people and young people. For all these, Frankl's books have answers. And one of our logotherapists in Georgia has coined a word which I found very useful. He said Frankl's books are bibliotherapies. You can get the therapy by reading the book. and I have tried to do this. I think my book and Frankl's main book, Man's Search for Meaning, is definitely therapy in itself. Many people have told him and have told me that our books have helped him directly without having to go through a therapist. So this was the purpose of my book, really, was to make available in a very simple, short, concise way of what may be most useful in Frankl's thinking to the American average, or not average, reader.
Okay. Shall we take it chapter by chapter?
We'll be glad to do that.
The first chapter, Personal Discovery. What did you intend with this chapter?
Well, what I intended to do with this chapter is to say that, see, my life, I became conscious of the lack of meaning on one day, namely on March 13th, 1938, when the Nazis moved into my